This is a production of Cornell University.
This question about why natural systems, why we have stability, and why this perturbation makes a difference, and I'll do that as well. Just to briefly, I want to get back to the model predictions here for a second, and let's see, where were we? Okay. All right, we'll do that. We looked at these a little bit ago. These are the emission scenarios. And this is, comes back into the economic things. These are color-coded. So for example, this red scenario, the high-end scenario, makes this assumption about population for the year 2100, that it's essentially the same as it is today. It makes this assumption about incomes, that they've gone up quite a lot. That makes this assumption about energy use per capita, or total energy use, distribution efficiency, which is and the fraction of energy that comes from fossil fuel sources. So all of these are the kinds of things that go into those scenarios that then you allow the calculation of this emissions history, which then goes into this calculation of the atmospheric CO2 levels. And so these are, that's why IPCC calls them scenarios, because we don't know what the population is going to be in the year 2100, nor do we know what the habits of those 7 or 12 billion people are going to be, right? This is a big deal, so we don't know that. So that's what goes into them. And then we look at some of these. These are some color-coded maps of how, you'll see in this one, how temperature and then how precipitation change. And so as we go from the blue colors, which are no change, to the purple colors, which are extreme change, these are under a couple of these different scenarios. And if we go back, we can say, oops, went wrong. This is the B1 scenario is not much carbon emissions. The A1 scenarios tend to have higher carbon emissions. The A1, let's see, which ones are represented in the next page? A1B and A2. Okay, so the A2 isn't listed here. Oh yeah, no, the A1B is this blue line, A2 is this blue line, and the A1B is this kind of middle of the road purple line. So we can look and say, okay, here's our B1, minimal carbon usage, all right, showing the, what we expect for temperature changes. And you can see that, and consistent with what we know from studying the past, we see the greatest temperature changes at the high latitudes, okay, particularly over the northern hemisphere. Antarctica is so isolated and so cold, it's hard to change its temperature a lot. It does change, but more slowly than other regions. Here's the A1B, kind of the middle of the road projection, and then here's the A2, the more intense carbon utilization. And you can see there, we're looking at temperature increases in the high latitudes of 6 to 8 degrees centigrade, which by the end of the century, which is quite a lot. So this gives you some sort of regional indication as well, and that's the big thing. The people in the climate modeling community are less concerned now with sort of getting the global average temperature about right, but they're more interested in predictions you can actually use. Because if I say the global average temperature is going to go up by 3 degrees, you go, okay, what am I supposed to do about that, right? But if I say, well, it's going to change, we're going to get this much change in precipitation, this much change in temperature in this region or in this state, then that starts to mean something to you, right? And that's the goal. And part of this is a computational issue, as the computers can do this on a finer and finer grid scale. They do it more accurately, but they also do it more usefully. So that's a lot of the activity in the field right now, is to do a better job of making regional predictions that can provide useful data for people to make policy decisions on in a regional or state or countrywide basis as opposed to a global basis. And here is some predictions for North America. Again, looking at temperature response, the average annual, the winter, the summer. Here's the precipitation response. So here, for example, on average, we would say the Southwest is going to dry, this region is going to wet up, and the Northeast is going to get moderately wetter according to this scale. This is about a 5% increase in annual average precipitation in, let's say, the region we're in right now. Whereas they're looking at maybe 10% decreases in precipitation in the Southwest. 10% decrease in precipitation in the Southwest is a big deal because they already don't have enough water, all right? If 10% decrease in precipitation some other places might not be that significant. So all of these numbers have to be filtered through the sort of local significance, you know. You sometimes read about these athletes, you know, these football players who bulk up from 280 to 310. right? So they can put on 30 pounds. If I put on 30 pounds, it wouldn't be a pretty sight, you know? So you don't want me to bulk up like that. So this is just, I mentioned that statistically. I've got this slide out of order. But this is, these are the records of climate in Europe for about 120 years and the entire range of variation and statistical fit to it. And then there's 2003. Something about that was extremely anomalous. It wasn't just an unusually hot summer. It doesn't fit. It's completely off the trend. So that's one of the things. And so then the just I want to go back up here a second.
How hot did it get in France?
The temperatures in where I was in Nancy were in 42, 43 degrees centigrade, which is in the mid-100s. I mean, body temperature is what, 38.7 or something? 37 point, yeah, I always get that wrong. That's, yeah, so the temperature was well over 100 degrees in these parts of France. And as near as anybody can tell, it hasn't been 100 degrees ever there. It was unpleasant. And, you know, it wasn't extremely humid, but it was just unremittingly hot, and it never cooled down at night. And what they found is that after, if I went back to that slide, that after a few days of this, you know, elderly people who were not in good health began to collapse. For a couple days of this, they could take, but day in and day out, this went on for a long time, and that's when they started to have the mortality, and it was quite a serious issue. But just before we go on, any questions about kind of the general aspect so of these climate predictions? Now, what we're concerned about is that a few degrees temperature change is actually a big deal, because it said 4 or 5 degrees centigrade temperature change is the difference between an ice age and today. Okay, now that's a dramatic example, and the next 4 or 5 degrees won't produce exactly the same effects, but it will be a fundamentally different world in which we inhabit if the mean global temperature goes up by 5 degrees centigrade. And so the concerns are, and you've read a lot about these or heard a lot about these in the media, you know, more storms, more flooding, more all these kinds of things. And the detailed effects of these are difficult to predict with any certainty right now. But we do expect sea level to rise, and that's going to have a big impact on coastal areas. And one reason is not that the sea level rises so much. Turns out a lot of coastal areas, for instance, get their drinking water locally, and the sea level comes up just a fraction of a meter, and you begin to salinize the aquifers. That's already happening on the New Jersey shore and in Long Island. They're losing the drinking water, partly because they withdraw it too fast, and partly as sea level has come up, areas like that are affected. So there's a lot of, many ways in which this kind of climate change affects the world we live in, or could affect the world we live in, and so that's kind of a whole other level of discussion about what are all the possible kind of direct human impacts. And that's been discussed extensively in the popular press, right? And predicting those with certainty is more difficult. For example, increasing the range of over which a malaria-bearing or yellow fever-bearing mosquitoes has potentially big impacts in some places, right? That's one example of how some kinds of diseases are going to invade regions where they haven't been before. Invasive species. In this area, what keeps out the riffraff is the low winter temperatures. All right, a lot of plants and animals and insects can tolerate most of the year in Ithaca, but it's those few days when the temperatures get to be 10 below zero or sometimes 20 below zero. That's what keeps out species from the south invading north. And we've seen fewer and fewer of those very cold days lately now, and we're predicted to have even fewer going forward. So species that are not native to this area can move in and won't be eliminated by the cold wintertime temperatures, okay, for example. The hydrologic cycle changes. We get different amounts of precipitation. We get that occurring at different times a year. And a consistent result of a lot of these climate models is that more of the precipitation we do get will come as intense storms, with potential for flooding and the difficulty in capturing those for water supplies. We were talking a little bit about this at lunch in respect to California. So these are the kinds of climate effects we expect to see, a few of them that we expect to see. And I don't think we have time to sort of exhaustively run through the list of possible what-ifs. But give an idea that it's not simply that the temperature changes. It's that the range of biological activity for both diseases and for crops in some cases with good potential benefits, and for invasive species with potentially not so great benefits can change, that the variability in the climate can change. Most predictions, most of the models agree that the climate will become more variable rather than less as a result of increasing average temperatures, and that has consequences as well. And then the idea that, in fact, we're going to see changes that are going to drive sea level variations, and that those may be a lot higher than we've anticipated because of this unexpected behavior in both Greenland and Antarctica. And a half a meter sea level change doesn't sound all that much, but it actually has very large impacts on coastal communities where much of the world's population resides. And if you start getting into, you know, single-digit meter sea level rises, that's a whole other story. I mean, a good part of Bangladesh is no more than 5 meters above sea level, has a population of 140 million people in an area the size of Wisconsin. All right, now, they move. This creates conflict between Pakistan and India, and then next thing you know, they're shooting nuclear missiles at each other. These are the kinds of things that you don't want to happen, right? So those are, you know, there's a lot of things down the road that nobody can really predict with any great certainty what's going to be the upshot. So I just thought I'd sort of, you know, gloss over those quickly to give an idea of the nature of changes that has people concerned, because the impacts are not merely on the climate, but on the people that live in it and how they respond, right? This matters. Yes?
Quick question, just for us. England, 7 degrees Celsius, what's that about in the Fahrenheit?
That's about 12.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that's a lot.
Over 32. 32 freezing?
32 is freezing, but no, 7 degrees Celsius
would be over 30
degrees. Yeah, right. So, I'm sorry, it would be about a 12 degree change. But this is just the change we're looking at, not the absolute temperature. This is the change we're looking at. Yeah, and yeah, scientists like to deal in Celsius, and people are used to dealing in Fahrenheit. I'm sorry, yeah. But you can roughly multiply by 2 and then take a little off. That's how I do it, a quick order of magnitude calculation. Multiply by 2 and then take a couple off. That gets you about right. So the one other thing I thought I'd quickly mention was a little bit about why we know why these systems are sort of coupled in the way that they are, and I want to just show some data on natural systems briefly to get a sense, because it's not just carbon. These are the composition of some biomolecules that exist in all of us. All right, turns out these phospholipids are what cell walls are made out of. Okay, and this is the amount of phosphorus they have in them, and this is the amount of nitrogen they have in them, and so we're made of carbon and water for sure, but the other important components, two of the most important ones, are nitrogen and phosphorus. All the amino acids, all the proteins contain lots of nitrogen. Lots of other biomolecules contain phosphorus. And these nutrients, as they're known, constrain the productivity of organisms all over the place. And so you can see that cell walls have a lot of phosphorus, not much nitrogen. Proteins have lots of nitrogen, not very little phosphorus. Nucleic acids like DNA in between. All these are common to all organisms on Earth. And the point is, you can't grow an organism on carbon alone. And here's the data from a bunch of different forests around the world showing the carbon distribution and showing that even though we have these forests from spruce forests in the north to tropical savannas to tropical jungles, the ratio of carbon to nitrogen or carbon to phosphorus is about the same in all of them. It's basic biological needs. A plant can't make more plant leaf without having enough nitrogen and phosphorus and other things to go along. Why is anybody calling me? I don't know. I don't want to hear it. So the result is then that we can't just add CO2 and let things grow better. And where do the nutrients come from in an ecosystem? It turns out that ecosystems need nitrogen and phosphorus to support their primary production each year, and almost all of it, in most cases well over 90%, comes from last year's debris that's recycled. And so here's an example. This is a screwy example, but it's one I had at hand. Turns out that this forest in New Hampshire that's been studied a lot needs about 250 or so pounds of nitrogen per hectare. That's 100 meter by 100 meter square per year to support its growth. Of that 115, it gets about 18 in rainfall, mostly from polluted air, which has nitrogen in it, fixed nitrogen in it. And then it gets about 100 from recycling last year's nitrogen. So the leaves fall off, they decompose, and they release the nitrogen. So if you were to go out there, and over a period of a few years, of all the bits of the forest that fell down, and you were to take them all away, within a few years the forest couldn't grow anymore because you would have removed the fertilizer. So natural systems recycle very, very strongly. And what that means is that the rate of growth is essentially has to equal the rate of decomposition every year. Because if 90% of the nutrients come from last year's growth to support this year's growth, last year's growth has pretty much got to be about the same as this year's, right? So in other words, these natural systems are the ultimate recyclers in that the things that they need, they retain very tightly. And so as a consequence, we tend not to see these large variations in the biological activity because they're coupled to other things. So we can't suddenly double the growth rate of someplace because we might have enough sunlight and water and carbon, but we don't have the phosphorus, so we don't have the nitrogen or something like that. Conversely, you're not going to fall off a cliff in most cases because last year's fertilizer to fertilize this year's growth is built into the system. One of the things that you see then in land clearing operations and in agriculture is that we take the fertilizer away. When you harvest crops, and one of the reasons we eat crops is because they have these energy-rich compounds and nitrogen-rich compounds in them. Soybeans are high in nitrogen, for example. So if you take those away, you're mining the nitrogen out of the soil. So the way you balance that is you put fertilizers back in. All right? And we've done that pretty successfully. And that fertilizer comes from natural sources, microbes that live in symbiotically with these other species. Those are not pictures of the microbes themselves. But I'll skip through that quickly. But that's where nitrogen fertilizer comes from. And the nitrogen fertilizer is primarily these days being made in the Middle East because it requires lots of natural gas. And the reaction is natural gas and water makes hydrogen. Hydrogen and nitrogen make ammonia. And with ammonia, you can make anything. And so most of this is taking place in the Middle East right now because it's an energy-intensive process, and it requires lots of natural gas. And so fertilizer is being made in places like that where it's clear it's not going to do them much good. You can fertilize these guys all you want. They're not going to be able to do much. And then if you look at what's happened is that this process was discovered in about 1910 and became widely implemented in the years following World War II. And fertilizer use has gone up tremendously. And this is essentially what has supported population growth in the world, this and plant breeding. So the main components of the Green Revolution that's allowed the world population to grow from 2 billion to 6 billion and going is plant breeding and the widespread synthetic manufacture of fertilizers.
So I would say that organic farming is a false kind of a production process for 9 billion people in the world.
It's not obvious how you can support 9 billion people in organic agriculture. You can probably do a lot better than you are now, but yeah, that is an issue.
We're going to need fertilizer plants.
We're probably going to continue to need fertilizer. Certainly right now
I do. I think it's not, organic farming isn't about nutrition. It's the same nutrition. You don't enhance the nutritional content of a food by organic fertilizer, but it's better for the environment. You can get everybody to do it.
And so it turns out that in the U.S., where does that fertilizer go? Well, this is the fertilized nitrogen. If we use 100 units, 94 are spread on the fields. 47 ends up actually in the crop. The rest of it gets washed off somewhere, ends up in the Gulf of Mississippi, screwing up the environment down there. But two-thirds of that is actually harvested. Most of that survives food processing and ends up in the food, and about half of that is consumed. So 14% of the nitrogen that's produced, or maybe 15% of the nitrogen that's spread on the fields actually ends up in our diet if you're a vegetarian. If you're a meat eater, the conversion efficiency is much lower because that's well known. And so the production of corn feed to feed animals is a big, very large demand on fertilizer and has lots of consequences there. But only a few percent of the fertilizer that's applied to fields and ends up in us in meat products. So these considerations essentially that we can't consider the carbon budget in isolation because, in fact, one of the things people say, well, doesn't CO2 make plants grow faster? Well, what you can see in an unfertilized system, you can add more CO2 and you get a little bit of an increase in growth, but then it plateaus out because the nutrients to support it aren't there. And you can add all the CO2 and water you want, but if the fertilizer, the natural fertilizer isn't there, you don't get any further response. So it's just an example of how these different biological systems are coupled so that you can't sort of change one thing without consequently having impacts or demands in every other part of the system. And that's why it's really, I mean, I guess what I, you know, I've been thinking about these things a long time, and I think what I've learned to do is think about, do a better job of keeping several mental balls in the air. But that's taken a long time to learn how to do that, and it's really pretty daunting. We all need to simplify things some, and what I find is, you know, as I've gotten more practice doing this over a long time, that I've gotten better at this, and I sometimes forget, and I'm talking to the students or whatever, and they're kind of giving me this blank look, because, you know, we do have lots of mental balls in the air, and when you start out, it's hard to keep more than one or two, because you don't know the things very well. But that nature, the fact that these systems are coupled, that we can't consider a component in isolation, we simply can't do it successfully, makes this problem hard, and it makes it fascinating, though, intellectually. And for all kinds of reasons, but it makes the problem hard to get a handle on, which is why global change isn't, and sustainability isn't just about CO2. It's not just about energy. Those are two big parts of the equation, but only two.
This is a question I've been waiting to ask. Are you saying that we should become vegetarians for the sake of the environment? Because I'm ready to argue it.
I think being a vegetarian is a lot easier on the environment than being a meat eater. But I think they're, I mean, you're a physician, right?
Yeah, and I taught nutrition.
Yeah.
The thing is that, and I've invariably alienated approximately 10% of the student body by suggesting that we've evolved. Hello. These are called incisors. And we have grinding teeth and we're omnivores. We're
right.
Supposed to be omnivores. It's very hard to get zinc out of plants. It's chelated. So is there's a bunch of them that are chelated.
Yeah.
Iron is chelated. It's great to get iron from heme sources, which is blood, which is in meat, you know. And you only need a little bit of meat. Now, if you could take this, you have your people who eat a little bit of meat. That would be me. But I think I'm getting what I need out of it. My micronutrients, the mineral. Then you have your caveman, which would be my husband. And he basically eats only meat and a lot of it. And that those are the people that I think are...
Well, I think that's... I think meat, yeah, our present meat manufacturing industry is actually pretty energy intensive and pretty hard on the environment, and there's a lot of room for improvement there. And you know, some of you read Michael Pollan's books. He's a wonderful writer. He wrote very interesting stuff. He wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and stuff like that, which are well worth a read. And it goes into this issue in some detail. But yeah, certainly one driver of energy consumption and fertilizer consumption is as people who don't eat meat very much because they come from relatively poor economic circumstances, as their standard of living increases, one of the things they want to do is eat meat. And I mean, I work with these Nepali guys, and they're very proud to tell me they have meat at least once a week in their diet. That was a really important step for them. And it's a matter of pride for them, in fact. So that's a big deal, because that has a big impact on agricultural policy, agricultural energy use, and fertilizer use and runoff. So those are another thing. But part of this is simply to say how coupled these things are. Now, you had a question, David, right?
I was wondering whether there's an alternative to using natural gas to produce synthetic fertilizer.
Yeah, well, people are working on that because, boy, these microbes can do it easy, right? And they've been doing it for a long time. And they have this incredibly complicated enzyme system that allows them to do this. And that nitrogenized enzyme has a molecular weight of over 200,000. It's this huge molecule whose sole purpose in life is to hold the nitrogen molecule just right so it can be split up. And, you know, this is a major discovery, a major achievement, just figuring out the structure of this thing. It makes you believe in special creation, you know, because these little microbes have this incredibly complicated architecture. So this Haber process for producing nitrogen fertilizer is actually quite cheap as long as the energy sources are cheap. And so no one has come up with anything that can compete with it on the scale. But people are working on various kind of genetic and biomolecular engineering approaches where maybe that could be replaced. But I don't think we're real close to doing that right now.
As we're talking about maybe replacing some of our coal usage with natural gas, we might want to consider conserving our natural gas for this process.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's natural gas, a significant chunk of the natural gas supply goes to fertilizer production. But the fertilizer production, we could not sustain 6 billion people on the planet for very long at all if we cut off fertilizer production. It would be catastrophic. And so everybody's pretty loath to tinker with a system that works until there's a very well-established alternative because, we basically had no longer, it's only in the past few decades we don't have famine in the world anymore, except in cases where wars disrupt things. And that famines were routine in Asia until the middle part of the century.
So there are people at Cornell in various departments working on this problem. Can we fix nitrogen in other ways that don't involve natural gas? And they're making discoveries. They're nowhere near discoveries that can be implemented. But people know it's a very important problem. And there are people working on it in chemistry and biochemistry and plant science and other places.
Yeah, it's a fascinating problem, but it's a hard one to do better than what the natural systems have done over all these many years.
Can you explain a little more what the problem is in terms of nitrogen runoff?
Okay, well, nitrogen is a fertilizer. So what happens is nitrogen runs off, and I think I have a picture to illustrate what the problem is. I want to skip past some of these. There's the problem. So nitrogen, a lot of plankton communities in the ocean are limited by nitrogen. You give them a lot of nitrogen, they bloom like crazy, and then they die, and as they sink, the bacteria that eat them consume all the oxygen, so the water goes anoxic, and then you have this lots of places, but famous place right now is the mouth of the Mississippi, the seafloor down is called the dead zone, because there's no oxygen down there, because nothing can live, and that's caused by agricultural runoff from up in the Mississippi Basin, dumping all these fertilizers into the Gulf of Mexico, provoking these plankton blooms that then consume all the oxygen. And although the plankton are producing oxygen as they're photosynthesizing, when they decompose and they sink, it uses all that that's dissolved in the water.
Put it more on a scale, like with the carbon dioxide, you put it really on a global scale of global consequence. Other than algae blooms?
Well, the algae blooms are significant because they actually affect marine productivity in a lot of places. And also, coral reefs are very sensitive to nitrogen pollution, for example, and coral reefs turn out to be a carbon sink. So that's another more complicated feedback, right? So, in terms of coastal regions, this can be a pretty important story. Right now, globally, we fix about as much nitrogen every year as all natural systems combined. You can see we're still doing CO2 that's only a percentage of natural fluxes of CO2, but we're doing nitrogen that's more than 100% of natural fluxes of nitrogen. And so there are consequences to this, including the promotion of harmful algae like red tide and stuff like that. So that's another whole complicated question, but it's an issue. I just wanted to bring this up to sort of the coupling between these different subsystems that you have to consider. So, this the nitrogen cycle in itself could be a whole story.
At Cornell that work on water and the relation to agriculture and all the other things that happen, and that it's not just the coastal regions that people are worried about, but the fresh water supply.
Yeah.
So we get clean water in a number of ways, but having the rivers be a productive biological communities keeps the water clean.
Right.
If you kill everything in the water from these algal blooms, then the water's not good.
Yeah.
I mean, and it also happens on us. It's the organic farming isn't solved.
Because
the manure is running into the rivers too.
And excess nitrogen in water supplies is a health hazard for blue babies. Blue babies are when there's too much nitrogen in the water supply, babies are born with this blue color, which is a result of excess nitrogen. So there are health issues and all that, but that's a whole other issue. But there's a whole bunch of things that are coupled together. It's just worth looking at how they are. So what I want to do is just sort of stop there and let Frank pick up some of these other issues. And, I think we talked, a bunch of us talked some at lunch about some of the climate issues and climate projections. We'll come back to that. We've got, what are some of the reasonable policies? And I guess I'll summarize some of our lunch discussion quickly, because we'll come back to this issue. And I think maybe this afternoon speaker will touch on it. In a sense, we can see that there's a good possibility that we're going to see significant climate change coming out of the greenhouse gas forcing that we're imposing upon the atmosphere, and that there's good physics behind that. We have a pretty good idea what's going to happen. We don't know the details very well, but the general trend I think we're pretty confident in. And some of those outcomes are not particularly attractive. So you have two choices, roughly speaking. One is to mitigate. In other words, do something about it now. Well, hopefully the costs are lower. And you prevent some of the problems that you deal with. And another is that you don't worry about it now, that you figure you're going to deal with the consequences later. That's called adaptation. And in fact, we're probably going to do some mix of those two in one way or another. But a lot of that boils down to, from a cost-benefit analysis, a lot of the choice between mitigation and adaptation boils down to what you think the value of today's dollar is going to be in the future. And traditionally, an economist would say the value of today's dollar is not going to be that much in the future, so you shouldn't spend it now to worry about a problem that's going to happen in 50 years. All right? That's the traditional economic analysis, and that's the discount rate, essentially. And so that, that, in a sense, is the core of the issue, is what... We're always dealing with uncertainty. There's nothing new about that. We deal with uncertainty in our daily lives all the time. This climate issue is a new kind of uncertainty, but it's still just another uncertainty about the future that we want to know about. You know, when we refinance our house, did we manage to get a really good rate, or is the rate going to drop further next year, or you know, all that kind of stuff, right? So we deal with these issues all the time. So the issue really boils down not so much to uncertainty, but to whether we think individually and collectively, it's better to spend some money up front now to avoid a problem, or whether we'd rather deal with the problem later when it, in today's dollars, it will be maybe cheaper. And how do we address that, right? And that's not a science question fundamentally. That's, we can pose it. We can even write equations about it. But ultimately, that boils down to sort of a political and moral choices. And that is, I think, what we should be. The debate should be. I don't think the debate should really be so much about whether global climate change is real or whether it's happening, because it is and it is. It's a question of degree. And I think for the most part that debate has died down in the scientific literature. It's still active in the political arena, and I find that unfortunate. But there are significant and important issues about what kind of choices we make in terms of what sorts of steps we should take now, what sorts of steps we should maybe not take now but be prepared to take, and what sorts of things are better off left for future generations, right? And so it's sort of a question of you can pose it two ways. You said the value of today's dollar is going to be not much in 40 years, but on the other hand, the value of my grandchildren will be a lot in 40 years. Which of those two is more important to you? And those are two, black and white questions, but it's not as easy as it sounds. Yes?
The answer may be fewer grandchildren.
Well, that's part.
Birth control might be a better option, of course, it's ethical and cultural and everything else, to making more nitrogen to feed the millions of impoverished people of the world. You try to tell other people of other countries, of other cultures, of other religions, to use birth control with Chinese.
Well, it's actually, birth rates are down a lot lower than people thought they were going to be not that long ago. The population projections have really relaxed when people figured out that women in very poor countries would take steps to control their fertility as soon as they just had a little bit of an economic window, when they didn't feel they had to have six kids in order to have one that would grow up that would support them. So population is part of the equation, no question about it. We already have enough population, and we've already built in enough population growth that we still get these issues even if we were able to stabilize population near where it is now, which is probably not true. As that population, as the standard of living in that population improves, that will be as big a driver. And we were talking about this at lunch. We're a society of 300 million. We're responsible for 25%, roughly, of the energy consumption and CO2 emissions, as Frank was talking about. Yeah, that's a good number, 23, 24, 25%. So we're 300 million people. Okay, so suppose 10% of China and 10% of India achieve a standard of living comparable with the average American. Not an unreasonable expectation over the next few decades. All of a sudden, you've doubled, you've nearly doubled that. Now, never mind Europe, okay? So I think the issue is really, population is not to minimize its importance, but this growth in standard of living, which is occurring lots of places, is going to have as big an impact as that. We've already built in the population increase. Once you have people, they have babies. Maybe they have a few. Or, Italy, the population's declining, I guess, but not so many other places. But this, the change in standard of living and in consumer habits is a big, big deal. And that's why the IPCC has these scenarios, because they don't know what's going to happen, right? They just try to come up with some likely range of possibilities, you know. What's a middle-class Chinese person going to be doing 40 years from now? Is he going to have the same habits as Americans do? Probably not. Are they going to be more or less consumptive of energy and resources? That's unclear.
Just to update, the latest actually is in 06, U.S. experienced an unexpected birth rate increase, and nobody knows why, but birth rates are actually going up in the United States.
Yeah. That must be it, yeah, I don't know.
Than ever before. And that's yeah. Because that's in the data, that's just, the latest data is from 06.
Yeah. There's a lot of short-term variation, I'm sure, and that's an interesting thing. It's interesting, there was an article a lot of you might have seen in the New York Times Magazine last week or so about why birth rates are so low in Europe and how it varied from country to country. And the interesting ones are the ones with the strongest kind of family support from mothers had the highest birth rates in Scandinavia, and the ones that didn't in Southern Europe and Italy and places like that, where they had a more traditional system for supporting mothers, which is basically having to stay home. The mothers are saying, I don't want to be a mother if that's the case, and they weren't having babies. So
also the father's paternal leave, not just the mother, but
yeah,
the father.
Yeah, so there are lots of policy things you can do to control the birth rate, but I think the big driver is going to be the economic status of those people who are already born and who are going to be born. That's going to be the big thing. As Frank used to say, no country in the world has a policy of negative economic growth. Right? So everybody wants economic growth. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means resources. What do the resources mean? Well, they mean a lot of complicated things. So I think that we built in a lot of this change. Part of it we're going to have to adapt to. Part of it we may be able to mitigate. But as we've seen, the time constant, the time scale is slow, so that things we do now will have their greatest impacts in 20 or 30 years from now. Nothing we do today is going to have a huge impact next year. And if we do nothing today, we won't see it that much next year. But in 25 years, we'll certainly see it.
I'm going to borrow the
ball. Oh, yeah, you need this guy.
And in listening to the discussion, instead of listening to myself talk, there are a number of things that kind of cross my mind. And one is that what we're trying to get across is that these sets of challenges, all interconnected challenges that we've been talking about, our natural tendency is to try to find the answer or the cause as if there were one. And what we've been trying to get across is there isn't one, that everything is really connected and you have to look at it as a whole system and try to approach it from a systems approach. It's a really tall order to do it both as an individual and even as a country, as an organization, to try to look at this as a system problem and to understand what are all the components that affect this and which things we actually have some control over that we can twiddle and try to have an understanding of what the effect will be, to minimize unintended consequences, almost always unintended consequences when we do stuff, but to try to minimize them because we realize that we have those all the time. So that's the first thing, is that there is no one answer, or as I've heard many people say, just around energy, there is no silver bullet. There may be silver pellets, a whole series of things. So the question about organic farming, we could frame in the same way. Organic farming is not a silver bullet. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't do organic farming or that it couldn't be part of a whole series of steps that one makes to reduce the use of artificial nitrogen, because not because artificial nitrogen is bad by itself, in and of itself, but that it consumes other resources that we might want to use for something else or whatever. And in the School of Agriculture, a lot of the research now around fertilizer is how do you minimize the runoff? And how do you predict what future conditions are going to be? The farmers in New York want to know, in 20 years, I want to know something about what to expect for growing season, for precipitation, for needs of fertilizer, how I can keep it out of the streams. I want to have very good predictions, because once I put it in the ground, it takes some time to get absorbed into the plants.
I want to know that in the next 3 weeks I'm not going to get a downpour that rushes it all into the river, which then turns out to be another problem, and so on. So there is a big economic driver for trying to give some guidance, even though we know that it's only probabilistic guidance, to all the economic activities in the state. One of the big drivers for obtaining some kind of idea about where global climate change may take things is the insurance industry. They have huge numbers of people working on global climate change and what that might mean for their industry. The banking industry, the same. So they are spending a lot of money on this and trying to figure it out and working with scientists and others. And at least of the groups that I've worked with, Lehman Brothers and a few others, they believe the data that's there, and they've got very good analysts. But they realize that there's a whole spectrum of possible outcomes out of this, and they try to figure that into their liability. You know, if they're going to insure lots of homes on the coast of Florida, and they figure in 30 years they're mostly going to be underwater, that's something they got to think about. And so there are lots of parts of the society that are pushing hard to try to gain information about this, to be able to make some at least somewhat educated decisions. Not that they're going to be absolute or that they're going to predict the future or whatever, but to know something about trends. So there's some big drivers. Let's see, what else? Population. We've been talking about population. So population is a great issue. And I have a few slides. And again, as we saw, all these things are connected. This comes up here. Is this off? Is this on? Yeah, it's on. Get it back on. So I think also the energy picture is going to be the same. We have a mixed set of energy sources. We're going to have a mixed set of energy sources in the future. And some of the reasons are that certain energy sources can't do it all, like organic farming can't replace all the nitrogen, but they can make a contribution. And we'll do those, and we'll probably do those on a regional basis. Where it makes the most sense to do biofuels, we'll probably do biofuels. Doesn't make sense to do biofuels of the traditional type anyway in the Southwest because we're limited by water. Maybe in the Southwest there will be some possibilities of doing algal fuels because they need less water. In the Northeast, in this region in particular, where there's lots of land that's marginal for growing food, it turns out a lot of that land is not marginal for growing certain kinds of biofuels. So it may be that the Northeast, in particular New York State, may be growing lots of biofuels. Not that the biofuels are going to meet all of the energy demand. That's absolutely clear it won't, and I'll show you some data on that. It won't meet all the energy demand, but it'll be a piece. And then we add up all the pieces, and then we have the whole story, just like we do now. So let's take a look. Let's see what I've got for the next slides here. I may dwell on some and not on others. Here we are. So we've seen this now. We don't need to talk about this at all. Let's see what we've got next. We saw a lot of this. This is just, by the way, this just shows you over the interglacial period, 100,000 years, how the CO2 has changed. And on this time scale, on this scale of the graph, you know, the last 200 years is so narrow that change in the CO2 concentration is just a vertical line. Okay, so trying to get a grasp on these scales and what the scales mean is challenging because we have to think on multi-scale on all these. And that's just kind of an interesting point that it's a vertical line and these go back for some way. And even something where I would have said it's a sure thing, you saw some disagreement. So Lou says, you know, maybe 100,000 years from now, Ithaca won't be under 3,000 feet of ice. I think it's likely, but I understand where Lou's coming from, because part of what people are worried about is that, you know, he talked about the last 25 million years looks like we had about the same CO2 concentration for 25 million years in the atmosphere, but there's been other times when we've had much higher CO2 concentration in the atmosphere in the past. It was also a much warmer planet. In any case, what people worry about is that there are various set points, and if you push too far from where we are now that it jumps to a different set point. And if you jump to a different set point, let's say a much warmer planet, this is what some people call, what's the name of the tipping point kinds of theories, tipping points that jump you to the next point up here, that next point may change things so much that it completely upsets the interglacial cycles. And I think that's what Lou was referring to as a possibility. We don't know if that's a possibility. I tend to be a bit more conservative than that. I think that,
just turned 64, he told me.
I just turned 64, I'm more conservative. I think there's a probability that, you know, we could burn all the stuff and we'll have a couple of hundred or maybe a few thousand years where things get really tough, but then the Earth will suck up the CO2, the processes will all come in, and we'll come back to equilibrium, and in 100,000 years we'll have another ice age. So that's a possibility also. What's that?
What causes the ice age?
Those are all still in play. That really has to do with the orbit of the Earth around the Sun and how it wobbles. It's not the same, and the tilt of the rotation axis and so on of the Earth when it's going around the Sun.
Changes in the amount of sunlight that the Earth receives, both total sunlight and whether it's in the northern and the southern hemisphere, and those trigger a bunch of these sort of feedbacks, which result in an ice age. The amount of change in the solar intensity that hits the Earth is actually pretty puny. It wouldn't cause anything like an ice age by itself. It's just telling you that the system can amplify those, first in one direction and then in another. And so that's why we have to worry about these feedbacks, because we know they're the whole story. Otherwise, we'd see very small changes.
Right. So clearly, this wasn't human beings. There weren't many human beings on the planet over this period of time. So it's not human caused. In fact, if you look back over 70 million years, the best reconstruction of what the temperature was from some zero, some change from some zero, what was the average temperature? If you look at the present, you know, this is in millions of years, so where humans have been on the planet, maybe we've evolved over the last 2 million years or something like that. That's a little sliver right down here. We grew up in the last 70 million years in a pretty cold period on the planet. Okay? And that we go back, and we can see that there were periods, we go back 40 million years ago, there were no polar ice caps, as near as we can tell. Of course, the land masses were in completely different places. The ocean currents were different. And you can see various things where things happened and the land masses moved around that changed the ocean currents, changed the global temperature, global average temperature. Okay, back in the time of the dinosaurs back here, this was a time where the planet was tropical everywhere. It was really warm. So we know these are things that we know a lot about, we know something about, and that people try from what we know about geology and everything else to try to recreate these in the models to give us some confidence that maybe those models will tell us what happens when we get a spike over here. But we don't have any spike, but that's all we've got. We don't have anything else. So
there's one other theory that the wrinkling of the Earth's crust and the mountain building eras have a big effect,
the big mountains, because they affect wind currents and the distribution of rainfall and all of that kind of stuff. So we see that presently today, with, let's say, the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevadas interrupt most of the moisture coming in, and one side of the mountains is quite wet and the other side's quite dry, and so on. So all of these things affect, and then the dryness. There's no clouds over there. It's much hotter over there. So most of the deserts are deserts because of the mountains interrupting airflow. Anyway, we don't need to look at these. Here's a slide where that emphasizes, again, from these models, if you do CO2 emissions that go up, this is 100 years, this is 1,000 years. If CO2 emissions go up and then they come down, that the effects last for a long time. It takes a long time for all of the system to come into equilibrium. But, you know, go 10,000 years. My thought is that, you know, they're mostly going to be back down to the baseline unless we reach a tipping point and we move the operating point and can't get back easily. So, you know, suppose we're going to take this all seriously. We're going to say, all right, what can we do? Let's be engineers. Let's do something and say, let's face this problem. And let's say we don't want to increase the amount of CO2 we're going to emit. We want by 2050 to be generating twice as much energy or twice as much power, but we're going to do it without increasing the fossil fuels that we're using presently. I'd say that's a pretty daunting challenge to just be able to do that. Let's not increase anymore. Let's see what it would take. I'm not sure we can do it, but let's see what it would take. So here we've got oil, gas, coal. We've got biomass, mainly this is wood that's being used, hydro, nuclear, other renewables, sun, wind, things of that sort. That adds up to the total of, in 2000, a little under what we had talked about for today, 12.8 terawatts instead of 14 terawatts. So let's suppose we're going to use 28 terawatts for all the reasons we've been talking about, driven by not only population but rising standards of living and so on and so on. And as I said, this was sort of the minimum. Lots of people think it's probably going to be 35 that we're going to need. But let's see. We're going to keep the oil, the gas, and the coal the same. So we're going to emit the same amount of CO2. And we're going to expand these other things. And let's see what the challenge might be to expand them. So the hydropower, it turns out that we can perhaps double or triple the hydropower on the planet. We're already being pretty effective at capturing hydropower in the rivers and the smaller rivers that have a reasonable drop so that we can capture the water, dam it up sometimes and whatever. So the best we could do with, as people have estimated, geologists and others, is something like a terawatt. So we need 14 more from here to get to there. Hydro itself is not going to do it. Nonetheless, we're going to do hydro because where it makes sense to do it, we ought to do it. Okay. Now, when we do it, we also have to think about other things, about the fish and the... And so there's ways to do it, I think, that we understand where we can take advantage of that and still deal with fish and other things that we know about. How about wind? We're going to do wind. But wind is only going to provide a piece. All right. If we take all class 3 wind on the planet that we know about, where places so-called class 5 is the highest, the most windy areas, class 1, the lowest windy areas. So class 3 wind is an average speed of about 5 meters per second, 10 meters above the ground. Those are all reasonable places to think about putting wind power in. If we look at all those places on the planet where we could do that, this is not out in the oceans, but a little bit offshore that it makes it reasonable to get the power in, we could do something like 2, maybe 3 terawatts. Okay, we're going to do it, at least in some places. We may not do it at this level, but we're going to do it. There are places where it certainly makes economic sense, and there are places, New York is doing it, and there are people making money doing this without subsidies at the moment already. So it's unlike solar. People are already doing it. Nuclear is a great one to talk about. We got some nuclear over here already. Let's look at nuclear. If we built 8,000 new nuclear plants, each nuclear plant's about 1 gigawatt, we'd have 8 terawatts. Right now, there are 400 nuclear plants on the power plants on the planet, 100 of which are in the U.S. We have the largest number. We talk about France being heavily nuclear. We have a larger number. They're just a smaller population. They generate a larger fraction of their electricity from nuclear, but they have a smaller population, so they don't have as many nuclear plants as we do. If we were to get that many nuclear plants between now and 2050, we'd have to be building a couple a week from now till 2050. Right? If you ask geologists how much yellowcake is there to run that many nuclear plants, the estimates are with
the uranium fuel.
The uranium fuel, yellowcake. The uranium fuel, estimates are from the known resources. Okay? Not the the reserves, not the known resources. I got it backwards. The reserves, what we know exists, we're fairly confident exists. We could run 8,000 nuclear plants for 20 or 30 years. Now we'll certainly discover more than that. But it's going to suggest that that may not be the best way to power those nuclear plants. We may want to go to what are called breeder reactors that actually make more fuel than they consume. But the fuel they make is plutonium. Now, plutonium is one of the most highly toxic radioactive elements that we know about. Tiny, tiny little bits in your body will give you 100% of the time bone cancer. 100% of the time. So now we have a world economy that would be based on plutonium, and every place on the planet that has nuclear power would have to have plutonium. People consider that a security issue. Every energy technology has consequences. I'm just pointing out one of them one of them here. I could point out consequences for all of these. Maybe we'll do this. It's a political choice. It's a trade-off. We have to decide, do we want to do that? Do we want to burn coal? What do we want to do?
Have we totally given up on fusion as a potential source?
I guess you could ask, who's we? There are scientists who are working on fusion. There is a huge project going on being built in France right now with basically world support of the program. It's called the ITER project, International something around, I forget exactly what it is, but it's a project that by around 2018 we should have an idea if the current understanding of plasma physics is sufficient to get to what they call self-sustaining ignition. So it will produce as much power as it consumes to just show that, and that self-sustaining, it'll just keep going. It won't put an electron into the grid. It's just going to show that, yes, it looks like we could, if we started pushing on this, it could go. We'll also test the materials that are used to build it. It's a very heavy radiation environment. They're fast neutrons. These are all, let me say what happens. You take deuterium and tritium, two isotopes of hydrogen. At high enough energy, you smash them together and they make helium and they give off a neutron. And that neutron comes off with a huge amount of energy. You take that neutron and you smack it into something to absorb the energy. You turn all that energy into heat. Okay? So this is a heat engine, just like a coal plant, and it's going to be subject to Carnot's laws. So we're going to take that heat and we'll turn it into steam. 60% of the heat has to go into the environment. 30 or 40% of the heat goes into making electricity. So it's a heat engine, just like burning coal. Now, what happens to the materials when those neutrons smack into it? These are, for those of you who are technical, these are something like 3 MeV neutrons. Okay, these are pretty powerful neutrons. And they smack into atoms and knock the atoms out of place and whatever. We know something about radiation damage to materials and think that there are some materials that will be able to stand up to that for a significant period of time, that you could run a plant for some period of time before you actually had to take the plant down because there was too much damage to the material to do that. So people are working on this right now to try to figure it out. If most technologists believe that if that experiment is successful, that this could be a technology that would affect the 22nd century. So it's a very long lead time to get from here to there. Nonetheless, if you don't start now, you're not going to get there. So that's the view that I get from talking to people. I don't work on that. There's some people on campus that do. And so that's the view. 22nd, did I say 21st? 22nd. So 100 years from now, maybe, it will be in a significant source. Lots of things could change. I mean, it could, if we found what we wanted to find and it looked very good and we put a big rush on it, maybe we could do it in 50 years. I don't know. But it's going to be a while.
Greg, what happened to solar?
I'm going to talk about solar.
Oh, because
it's not on my list.
It's not in there at all.
It's up here under renewable, but I didn't put it up here. I'm going to get to solar. These are just various possibilities of what we can do.
So ITER will not produce any electricity on the grid?
No, ITER is not going to produce any electricity for anybody. It's just an experiment. It's a science experiment. On a scale it's believable that would say, if that works, now we can have some confidence that we could move forward with that as a technology, to build it into a technology. Okay, how about biomass? So you heard something about, you know, how much sunlight is converted into plant growth, and it's a large amount of sunlight. The equivalent in power is about 90 terawatts of sunlight is converted, captured, and turned into biofuels on the planet, growing plant matter on the planet and in the oceans. About 90 terawatts. That's a pretty big number. Most of that is not easily accessible. It's out in the ocean, or it's here and there. If we took all the cultivatable land that is currently used on the planet, stop growing food, just take all the cultivatable land and use that to grow biomass of a certain type, we could probably produce about this much energy from the biomass. So again, that's not going to fill in the whole wedge, and we're not going to stop growing things. We're not going to stop growing food, obviously. We will, in some areas, take non-productive land that wouldn't be very good for food and grow biomass, as I already suggested, but we're probably not going to grow this big a wedge. So this is not to say that any of these things are bad. This is to say that there is no silver bullet, at least in this list of things. We will do some of these. Okay. I don't know what the mix will be. I don't know how many nuclear plants we'll permit, but we're going to permit some more. There's no doubt about it. It'll happen.
These energy requirements are based on the population.
In part.
Both the as Lou was saying, both the population and the increasing prosperity of more people on the planet. So it's both things are driving it. Even if the population didn't increase at all, the fact that the countries like India and China, not to pick on them in particular, Brazil and others are going to be in the same category and not too long, are becoming wealthier and their standard of living is rising and their energy consumption is going up.
Has anybody thought about limiting the population?
Sure. Lots of people have, and we'll talk about that. And so the question is how?
Sure.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. We can talk about that a lot. The question is really how. It's not, and there are lots of different approaches to that. And it's who's limiting whose population. That's a very tough political, moral, and ethical issue. But nonetheless, there we are. Okay. So this suggests, you know, the challenges are big. These are big challenges, there's probably no silver bullet. Now, having said there is no silver bullet, there may be one. And it's what we've been depending on since the birth of the planet, and that's the sun. So all the stored fossil fuels that are on the planet come from plant growth that came from the sun and whatever. All that energy that's here came from the sun or other suns. So all the nuclear elements, all the radioactivity in the planet came from other suns that blew up and then recondensed and so on and so on. And eventually you get uranium and things. So the whole core of our planet is hot because of radioactivity in the core generating enough heat to keep the interior of the Earth or parts of the interior of the Earth molten. It's hot enough from all that radioactivity. And maybe we can tap into that as a geothermal source. That geothermal source will be more tapped into in the future. We will use it. Again, it's not going to be one that's a silver bullet, but we're going to use it. But the amount of energy coming in from the sun is enormous, and you've probably heard some statistics about this. So we use 14 terawatts. The amount of sunlight hitting the Earth continuously all the time, some part of the Earth, continuously all the time, is 120,000 terawatts. It's huge. There is more energy striking the surface of the Earth in 1 hour than we consume in 1 year on the planet, in under 1 hour than we consume on the planet. So there are lots of thoughts about how can we capture that sunlight and use it more effectively. We capture it by photosynthesis. The energy coming in from the sun that's converted in photosynthesis, only 1% of the energy actually ends up in the plant. 99% of the energy is lost in that process. We want to do something that's more efficient than that so that we can capture more of that energy. So scientists think that the practical amount that we could capture, given current technologies, not worrying about cost, but given current technologies, is maybe 600 terawatts. That's a lot more than we're planning to use in the foreseeable future. That sounds like a good place to go. Depending on the land fraction that we might use, again, if we're not using the oceans, and the land fraction costs and all kinds of other things, the estimates really vary between these numbers. It's a big, big, big range. Solar photovoltaics that are 10% efficient, those are quite poor photovoltaics. The current technology is approaching 20%. But if we did that and took a 600 terawatt as kind of an average number in here, converted at 10% efficiency, that would produce 60 terawatts. And that's pretty substantial. Okay, so that's why people are very interested in photovoltaics. Cost is a big issue with photovoltaics. Storage is a big issue with photovoltaics. It's expensive. So we'll talk about how expensive it is in a bit. So storage is another issue because the sun doesn't shine all the time. It shines on some part of the Earth all the time, but since the Earth is rotating, obviously it's not shining here all the time, and we've had a fair amount of rain and so on. So even through the clouds, you get some solar energy down to a photovoltaic, but you don't get as much as when it's sunny out. So we would need to store energy on a massive scale that's many orders of magnitude above what we know how to do presently. And we're trying to figure out what are the ways that we could store all this energy so that when the sun isn't shining or we have winter time and we're not getting as much energy from the sun, we have energy that we can use. So that's a huge issue, and people are working on it. So these are things I think are going to happen. I feel fairly confident the technology is going to get there. What I can't tell you is how fast it's going to get there. I can't tell you exactly what it's going to cost. There has been an enormous amount of investment in this area, not by the federal government, but by private money. Okay, so right now it's a lot of private money that's going into to trying to push this. So let's say a few more words about it, I think. So here's looking at underused renewable energy resources on this funny logarithmic scale that we looked at before. So every time you go up here, it goes up another factor of 10. Okay. So this compresses things so that things that are very different can show up on the same graph. And so if I look at hydropower, that was down here at just under 1 terawatt. Okay. Tides and currents, that's another one we didn't talk about. People are going to do that. And they're going to do that in the United Kingdom, for example. Any place that has a lot of coastline compared to their land area ought to use the tides as an energy source. So when the water's coming in, you let it run turbines when it's coming in, and when it's running out, you let it run turbines when it's running out, especially in places where you get large tides between high and low tide, lots of difference. So people are going to do that, and that's going to generate a few terawatts. Wind is going to generate a few terawatts. Geothermal, somewhat better if we can take advantage of it all across the planet, and we can do deep geothermal. Current use, right around here, solar is just gigantic. Right, so that's where in my opinion, that's where the future is. So the human race can depend on this for a long time before we get to points where we're using so much power, even the sun won't do it. But that's not going to happen in the time period that I'm thinking about. For our great grandchildren, we're not going to use anywhere near that much energy. But boy, that's a very attractive place to go, it seems to me. And we keep saying, you know, that the questions are not either or it's just one, this or that, or this is the cause and this is the result. Everything, energy is connected to everything else. Every piece of the energy picture is connected to everything else. The challenges are much more than technical, as we've been talking about. They're ethical, social, and political, as well as economic and strategic.